best shopping maniacs. You are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, Chris. I'm doing okay, you know, as well as I can. I'm in the booth again. I got my equipment set up here. I've been playing with my audio equipment a little bit just because
it looks good. You know, it looks good.
Does it? Okay, thanks. I hope it's okay. The only difference in the booth here is I bought this little cloud lifter thing, which supposedly pairs with this SMB7S, whatever it is, the Shure mic, because it's low on gain, and this thing gets some free gain. Anyway, hopefully I feel really gainy. We have our very favorite guest here on Chop Talk Show this week, probably been on the show more than any other guest, Jen Simmons. Hey, Jen.
Hello.
Jen's the best because she knows all kinds of stuff about HTML and CSS and browsers and how they work and who to talk to and what's happening and just everything. And Jen, actually, you have maybe a little bit of news for us, huh?
Yeah, I haven't talked about this publicly yet, but here, I'll do it right here. People probably, if you know my work the last 5 years, you know that I've been a developer advocate at Mozilla, but I'm going to be leaving Mozilla and becoming a web technologies evangelist at Apple.
Whoa. Apple! The big Apple.
At Apple with the Safari team, the WebKit team. Yeah.
That's
excited. I'm excited. I haven't started yet. I don't work there yet. Although I guess when the podcast comes out, maybe I'll have started by then. But yeah.
You'll be about 4 hours into your Monday. You'll be right through employee training.
You'll be thinking about lunch. Thinking about lunch.
I'll be waiting for California to wake up is what I'll be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you don't know much about the things. You know that there's some little dancing involved you let us know about, which is funny, like, you know, not necessarily resigning, but, you know, you like leave the CSS working group board because you're no longer a representative of Mozilla and then are immediately, you know, what?
Rejoining.
Joining again.
Yeah, as an Apple, as a representative from Apple. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the browsers are different, the teams are different, the companies are different, but in many ways I'll get to do very similar work in advocating for what so many of us advocate for, which is a really healthy web ecosystem where technically we have the tools we need, we have the features and CSS or HTML or JavaScript or the APIs that we need, and we've got ideas about best practices and so...
Well, it's a big deal to me to have you there because I think you just bring so much clarity to what's going on with browsers that there'll be more clarity from that angle. And so what about, I mean, this is, you know, it's WebKit is the name of whatever you want to call it, a rendering engine. I'm terrible at knowing how to call stuff like that, but it's Safari. And I even decided on CSS Tricks, I'm not even going to like try to play the game anymore of like what to call the right thing. I call it Chrome, Firefox, and Safari. And everybody knows what I mean, you know, like even if I'm talking about it's a WebKit feature or something, I'm like, who cares? It's a Safari feature, you know? I don't know if that's like good for the web or not, but
yeah, I mean, I think most web developers, most people who make websites are thinking about the browsers, and that's the name of the browser: Safari, Edge, Chrome, UC browser, QQ browser, Samsung Internet browser, but the Safari, Firefox browser, but the there's the rendering engines, which are really just the core, the plumbing underneath it all that actually renders the page. There are fewer rendering engines than there are browsers. So the Blink rendering engine is used by Chrome. It's now used by Edge. It's used by Samsung Internet. It's used by Opera. It's used by a bunch of other browsers. Where the WebKit rendering engine is used by Safari. The Gecko rendering engine is used by Firefox. Mm-hmm.
So that much, I feel like I got it. But then you're like, then you talk about JavaScript or something and you're like, this is how Blink does JavaScript. And then you're like, whoa. Yeah. No, Blink doesn't do JavaScript. V8 or something does JavaScript. And then you're like, oh, shoot.
Yeah, it gets complicated because then also sometimes it's the operating system that does the heavy lifting. And sometimes it's the browser rendering engine that does the heavy lifting. And it's not the same in other different browsers might be different about like who does this part of the font rendering. That's the kind of stuff I ask people who understand browsers more than I do when I want to know answers to those questions because I don't know either.
Wasn't it? I think Chrome just this week released new, like a just a slight UI refresh on what form controls look like. So something like the meter element looks a lot different than it did. It used to have this kind of gradient, glossy look to it, and now it doesn't. And checkboxes look a little bit different, and stuff like that. And it's nice. I think most people applaud the effort, especially because there's some accessibility stuff that comes along for free. But then,
well, and that effort's been driven by folks at Edge, Greg Whitworth, and people at Edge. And they've been collaborating heavily with the folks at Chrome, especially because now they do share the Blink rendering engine.
Right.
But a lot of that work is not just about Blink. It's about web standards, actually. It's about figuring out how ultimately, how can we give authors, people who write CSS, especially people who write the code for websites, access to styling form controls, so that you don't have to reach for a JavaScript framework and you can still use all the proper semantic HTML.
We didn't get that yet, though, right?
No,
we
just not yet. But this is one step in that direction. And it also is a little bit overlapping with dark mode. I think all the form control stuff was put into browsers a million, trillion, zillion years ago. And it's old code and nobody wants to touch old code, especially if it's like 10 or 20-year-old code. But they've had to. The browser engineers have been kind of forced to go into that code because of dark mode, because they had to make dark mode versions of all their form controls. And once they got in there, they're all like,
clean house.
Yeah, this is a big nest of awfulness that we've been knowing that this is a nest of awfulness and we should fix this anyway for authors. And we've been meaning to get to it, but we haven't because nobody wants to touch the old mess of awfulness. But when you're forced to, you might as well get in there and do it right. So that's what this is about. It's like, so the CSS working group is working on it. Other working groups are working on it. It's a slow rolling multi-vendor, multi-year process to actually get us to a place where we have what we want.
With my clients, I always say we have to mow the lawn before we can do any landscaping is sort of the analogy I like to use. That's
nice.
From my coffee table book on web analogies that I'm going to put out here. I'm going to have all of them, architecture, landscaping,
sports.
Sometimes you have to level set everything, make all your little widgets match, and then you can think about that stuff like dark mode or even, how do we let a user style this,
Right. Yep.
It seems like the baby step so far where let's make checkboxes and stuff support pseudo elements. So then if you need to use those to force styling over a cool, it seems like that's a temporary-ish, and that ideally you can use not other pseudo elements that are named that are for that job rather than kick it off the page and use the pseudo element in its place to do something else. Weren't I feel like you were just talking about or getting opinions or something on one that was very specific to the file picker.
Oh yeah, because we were talking about it in the CSS working group. They were naming a pseudo element to be able to address the button that you use when a user uses when they upload a file. So it's like not the regular button. It's like a special button for file upload inside the file upload thing.
Right, right.
And we were naming that, and naming can be complicated and hard to do. And we were doing it kind of quickly, knowing that we could immediately reopen that issue and rename it a different name later if we need to. But in those moments, sometimes I kick a tweet out where I'm just like, I don't have time to think about this carefully. I'm just going to see what the crowd thinks.
I think I saw one of the first responses is that name final?
the
name people
right.
didn't like immediately.
Because we get stuck with the names forever. So
yeah.
But also, you don't want to spend 45 minutes discussing a name on an hour-long phone call.
True enough. The type equals file input, it has been notoriously difficult to style. So it's cool to see little baby steps in that.
Yeah, and another one that's underway is one of the things that's most challenging about styling all these form controls is getting rid of the default styling that was there before you start applying your own styling. And so for a while now, there's been this WebKit appearance property, this prefix property, that's a throwback to when we had prefixes. So and it works in more than just WebKit. It works in a lot, maybe even all the browsers right now. I don't know. But it was just quickly drafted and I assume, and it was just kind of like, so there's been an effort. I think Mozilla actually hired a Galia for a year to work on this, to mm-hmm. hunt down what is the ultimate solution so that the CSS working group can properly spec the appearance property as a real CSS property.
Well, that's its all fun journey, wasn't it? My gosh, we could spend the whole time talking about that.
Yeah, and I don't know the details. I'm pulling them off the top of my COVID-addled brain, so I'm not really sure. But anyway, it's complicated. This stuff is really hard. There's a lot of old, ancient technical debt, which makes it harder than other things are. And everybody's working on it. Everybody realizes what we would ideally like to get to is a place where every form control can be fully styled 100% in CSS, and you don't have to replace the HTML elements with whatever, div, div, span, 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 JavaScript, JavaScript, JavaScript. That there's anything wrong with using JavaScript if it's the appropriate solution, but that you wouldn't be forced to use it because there was something lacking in CSS or HTML.
Sure. And the classic talking point is like, sure, replace it, but it's really hard. It's like, it's pretty spectacular. Just think of a select element. Well, you need to tab to it. It's got to have a focus style. And then there's a way to like open the select menu. Like, what is it? The space bar, the return key, or whatever. Whatever you code in JavaScript better be exactly what the browser does too. If the browser supports two different keys to open it up, then your JavaScript better support the two different keys to open it up.
Yeah.
Then the arrow keys need to work to get through it, and the tab keys need to work too. And then how do you select one of them? Is it return or is it the space key again? Well, whatever the browser does, that's what your JavaScript needs to do. And there's a pretty close to 0% chance that you're going to get it right.
Yeah.
And so another thing I think of with selects, though, is like, so there's the outside of a select and the inside of a select. And the outside has been getting a little easier to style over time. And I think we're almost to the point where there's some pretty decent patterns out there for styling the outside of a select, just like what it looks like by default when you're just unopened and just looking at it. And then it immediately punts on the inside. Like you can't do anything in there. Once it opens up, then it's just operating system. And what's funny about that is that the inside doesn't come from the browser. It comes from the operating system, I think, which is one of those weird little tricky things.
It gets complicated. A lot of these form controls, they are replaced elements, which, hey, we're going to talk about that more later too, what a replaced element is. Like, they are not part of the like website code. They're part of the browser. The browser's like, hey, I have radio buttons for you. Let me give you one. Here it is. Boom.
Yeah.
And it kind of like the HTML says, hey, I'd like to have a radio button. And the browser is like, I have one of those. Here it is. And browsers do that differently. And browsers do that differently, especially depending on what operating system they're using or what device they're on. So a phone is going to do that differently than a desktop browser, or a tablet browser might do that differently than another browser because, hey, you have a phone with a touchscreen. You would like to have a different keyboard show up. Oh, you're at a computer that just has one hardware keyboard. Well, you're just going to use the hardware keyboard, right? Like, so we want that. We want that user experience design where, you know, the color picker that shows up, for instance, is appropriate to the context that you're in and is part of the operating system. And it matches the color picker that you're using and all of the other pieces of software as a user that you're using color pickers in. But then that means the website, like, it just gets some brand wants the color picker to look like their brand. It's like, well, no, because the color picker isn't part of your website. The color picker is part of the operating system. And
which is kind of good, right? I heard that the color picker is going to start having a eyedropper in it. And the eyedropper should be able to grab color from anywhere on your whole screen, which, of course, only the operating system can do. But how rad is that, you know? Like, that would be a real limitation to design software on the web, is that you just don't have that cool color picker that you would in a native app. But I love it when the web gets little tiny things like that that make it more competitive to desktop.
Yeah, apps. And color spaces. I mean, there's so many different color spaces. So if your team is trying to hand make your own color picker, is it only going to be RGB, or is it going to be HLS, or is it going to be the new fancy color space that just came out in the fancy fanciness? Like, are you going to rebuild your color picker 2 years from now because there's a new color space on some of your user's operating system? Like, no, you don't want to do any of that. You just want to call the color picker. You want the color picker to show up and you want the color picker to do its job. So, and that's a more extreme example, but it's sort of a blurry gradient between, you know, a checkbox, well, or like a, you know, a text field with a button is sort of simple, and the color picker is really complicated. And I don't know, like everything, there's this blurry thing in between, like numbers and keypads and select lists. And yeah, so that's why it's not going to be something that's going to hurry up and, oh, we got this whole thing solved in 3 months and we shipped a whole bunch of new CSS properties and we're done. It's like, no, this is kind of a multi-year project to solve this.
Well, and even like you think of like a date picker or whatever, dramatically different between a desktop and a mobile browser. Just
right.
Just fundamentally different. You get the little, I don't know, slot machine UI usually on a mobile
so
thing.
Weird.
And then you get the kind of full calendar app, which is also kind of weird. Like, I mean, I guess that's the best way to pick a date, but it's like, oh, I just got to like click like 12 years into the future if I want to do that, you know? So there's always those weird things. So, yeah, it's, I'm curious how it'll shake down. So
do you think those are going to become one tiny little corner of the web, isn't it?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think those are going to become like standards, like the Mozilla thing would be the same as the Chrome thing, as same as like the, you think they'll all kind of be just whatever those users or platforms or whatever need?
Yep.
That's, yeah.
I think it's going to remain complicated for good reasons, because it's better user experience.
Yeah. And so the spec just says stuff like, and then the browser shows whatever it wants to. Like,
you know, right? I don't know. I haven't read those specs, actually.
I feel like that's the vibe. I haven't either, but I think it just kind of punts, you know? You're like, then show a date picker if you want to or don't. Up to you.
Well, you know, it would be different, there's some innovation concerns. I mean, if Apple would have launched with a date picker or whatever, or a select box, you know, and it just, the iPhone with that, you know, and it would have been like 10 miles long, everything flying off the screen when you select your country, like, they probably made a very smart decision to like break the convention there. And same with like maybe the date picker, like, yeah, maybe like using a calendar on your phone isn't that radical, like inside a web form. So there's good innovation. I don't know. So.
Yeah. And on its face, this seems simple. You know, it seems like, hey, every user should get a really great experience and every team should be able to brand that experience with their brand. Why don't we have that? Like, well, because, it's one of these things where the simplicity and the ease of user experience is one of these, actually, it's really complicated to make something that beautiful and elegant and simple, and branding is complicated, but
so
it's being worked on anyway, bit by bit. Yeah. And there are, like when I, last summer I was making a lot of demos of form controls for HTML, for the HTML course that I put together, I sort of explored myself, what is stylable right now? You can style checkboxes. You can style radio buttons. You can style text fields. You can style buttons. There's a lot that can be styled. And so I encourage people to do that as much as possible, and to reach for other tools, JavaScript or whatever, frameworks or whatever, when you hit the limits of today's technology. When you have to style a select, for instance, you're going to need to reach for something.
Even that one's fascinating to me, because there's the styling of the outside, the styling of the inside, and then functionality too. So some people like don't even care so much about the styling necessarily. They just wish that you could, for example, type in ALA and or AL and get Alabama and Alaska, a trimmed down list. And maybe you can select both of them and not just one of them, and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, there's a need for a search bar in the top of a select list in many, many projects.
Right. Like data list-esque, which is kind of cool that data list kind of, I don't know, broke ground there a little bit, and that it does work like that. You type in and you get a trimmed down list of... This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Heffler & Co. Welcome as a sponsor. I am stoked about it. They are my favorite type shop out there. The URL is one of the best URLs you could possibly imagine, typography.com. Nothing is more critical to a good web experience than just clear, clean, attractive typography, which is good news because that's not particularly hard on the web anymore. You know, type on the web has just gotten so good. It's affordable and easy to integrate. Heffler & Co. fonts are the designers of some of the world's most beloved typefaces, like Gotham and Knockout. You know, the CSS Tricks logo? It's just Gotham rounded. all caps, CSS-tricks. That's it. And I've used it for so long, I feel like it's striking. I feel like it's just coming into its own, really. I really like it still. But all the typography on CSS-tricks is also Heffler Co. fonts. Ringside, Sentinel, Operator. Ringside is the title. Sentinel is the serifed body copy. And I've only been using it now for, what's it been, 3-4 months? And I just love it. In fact, my own team just yesterday complimented me on the typography of the site and said it's really, you know, I've been tweaking it forever. It's finally really beautifully come into its own. It's something I take really serious. And Operator Mono is just my favorite monospace font for code, you know? Really, it was one of the first ones out there that had the kind of slight cursive look for italics, which was just genius and has been copied many times since. I love it. So at typography.com, you'll find nothing but the highest quality fonts. They're screen optimized for the browser, complete families, deep character sets, clever features to help you solve design problems, you know? And then on the site itself, there's free tutorials and stuff to help you become a better typography. Oh, thank God I could use it. Download their fonts to self-host them, or it's $99 a year to get a cloud typography subscription, which lets you use the entire library for $99 a year. And you get 15% off that if you use coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW at checkout. Just one word, SHOPTALK at checkout. Typography.com/SHOPTALK gets you that deal. Incredible deal, incredible fonts. Thank you for the sponsorship. Love it. There used to be this thing called lynda.com, and then it sold to LinkedIn, and now it's called LinkedIn Learning, and you have a brand new course on it.
I do. I have a course on LinkedIn Learning called HTML Essentials, which is a long-running course that they've had for years, and it needed updating, and they reached out to me, and I made a course, and now it's online. So it's all the new thing, and it's not a kind of a course that's like, assuming you knew the old stuff and now it's updating you, or assuming you want to know the long torrid history of all the different, it's just like, no. You're busy. You want to know how to use HTML. What is the deal with HTML in 2020? Here it is. Here's how to do images. Here's how to do responsive images. Here's how to do forms. Here's how to do semantic HTML. What is a paragraph? What is a link? And it's really for anybody. It's for people who are on some kind of web content team who, you know, were English majors in school and they're all about writing and marketing maybe, and they don't know anything about technology, but they have to click over in their WordPress blog to the HTML section and it freaks them out and they don't know what any of that stuff is. Like, it's that kind of thing. But also, I've tried really hard not to make it, because I think for any of us who are a little bit more advanced, trying to take a beginner course is really annoying. It's like, it's not a beginner course. I think LinkedIn Learning does have an even more simple beginner course. And this course is like, oh, you might be a PhD holding computer science major who's an expert in Java and something, something. And now you're like, you switch to the web team and this HTML thing is weird and annoying and you're not really sure which element you're supposed to be using for what. You don't really understand it. So the course is really for both audiences at the same time.
That's nice. I can see, you know, even though it seems like HTML gets typecast as like the easiest thing that we all do as front-end developers, you'll know that it totally isn't. And if the longer you spend away from it, I think anybody who can appreciate a course like this coming back into it, like, let me just see, especially how you put it, like the 2020 HTML, you know, like, it's been a while. Just give me that stuff. I know extremely smart people that take courses on really basic stuff all the time just to get the, like, just to feel like they read the manual, just to be like, you know what, I see this stuff now, you know.
It was a little bit interesting, maybe I'll use that word, to realize how much I learned while putting the curriculum together for the course, where I was like, yeah, you know, I don't really know this part of HTML. Maybe I'll board up on this and get, like, find out the expert actual answer to what you're supposed to be doing before I write this chapter.
Isn't that funny? To try to write something, do a video on something, it will expose every misunderstanding you have, every bug that exists with the thing. You know, if you got to do QA, I do QA for like a new feature or something that I'm working on, and I'm just like, this looks good to me. Let me shoot a video quick. 10 bugs I find, you know, or 10 things that I'm like, how does that work? So cool. Yeah. do a
All right, I saw a video of you. You explained code pre and BR, and I just was like, "Yeah, I couldn't do that. I don't. Is it code before pre or pre then code?" Sometimes you just do. Oh God,
I spent a long time, like almost a year, writing the curriculum. But the course is under 3 hours. I think it's two hours and 45 minutes or something. It turned out. So,
yeah, that's awesome. It's like a perfect like skill buff for somebody. Like we're just like an English major who now is finding themselves doing websites or something, or you know, I think a lot of like managers who maybe don't have like the full technical suite, like this would be a great like place to start, or you could even point your manager towards that. So when you're talking about like, oh, we need a new text area or something, like you can, or why it's more complicated than that, you could kind of like whatever, bridge that gap. You could fill in the knowledge gap between you and maybe a manager or somebody like that. This is pretty helpful stuff.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that people struggle with HTML is that they want to know which element they're supposed to use when, right? That's the big question. Mm. And there are some answers. Like you should use one of the headline elements when you have a headline. You should use a paragraph element when you have a paragraph. You should use form field elements when you have form fields. But I think sometimes it's hard for, especially engineers, when there's an ambiguity, when maybe there's not like a clear answer. There's not a specific rule about when to use an H3 versus when to use an H4.
Or worse ones, like a section or a citation.
Or should you use a regular list, unordered list, or is this a definition list? Like, what is a definition list again? What exactly is that for? And, you know, as I dove into this very, very deeply, I kind of realized that the reason that there is that ambiguity is because, and I'm a believer that HTML is a programming language. It's a different kind of programming language, but it is a computer language. It's for computers. It's not a human language. But it bridges the gap between human communication and the way that computers think and computer machine code. It's actually the only language that I know of, or maybe there's some other obscure ones, but in our world of all the languages that we use, it's the only one that really is trying to take human meaning, which is so complicated. The fact I just said so, right, instead of so, like the way you use your voice, the intonation, the exact words.
You EM'd it. That was an EM. Yeah.
That was an EM, right? You're trying to take that complexity of human communication and translate it to something that computers can understand. And so there isn't always a right answer. It is messy. Like, that's what it means to write when you're writing. That's, you know, if you work for a newspaper and you have a newspaper editor rewrite your weekly column and help make it better before it gets published in the newspaper, like they're picking through and choosing the words and saying this word, that word. There are rules of grammar that are very clear sometimes, and then there's a lot of ambiguity in a lot of places where it's just polish or it's opinion or it's skill. It's the art of writing. It's not a rule. And so I think HTML reflects that. And so I try to communicate that in the course too, to be like, here, I'm going to tell you the rules, but then I'm also going to show you the ambiguity and the places where it is more of an art and it's not. And so I also think that engineers shouldn't, if you have these scared, weird feelings because you're like, I don't know, this is stupid. I don't know how to do this. So therefore it's wrong because I couldn't be wrong. Like, okay, have those feelings and realize that you're not doing it wrong. It's just ambiguous because it's about human meaning and there isn't a clear answer.
It's like it's a programming language that maybe it's very syntactical, but it has a grammar almost, you know, there's a kind of a right and a wrong way to express something. And that's different than maybe a lot of programming languages, you know, they don't care if you wrote a while loop or a for loop, that one's maybe better than the other, but they don't care. Yeah, I think of like, I get these debates are so tired to me. I'm getting old. I turned 40. I've crossed the threshold to curmudgeon. But the like when people are like, HTML is not a programming language. And it's like, well, I can write an H2. And that's like a function that makes a screen reader say heading level 2. You know, like it's you don't know that when you get started or you don't use a screen reader or something like that. But these things have, they have meaning and there's, yeah, I was on, front end. Oh, I'm going to murder it. I feel like I was on a podcast. Dave, Rupert, you're terrible. Web platform podcast, that's it. And they, you know, just even just using the example of a list, you know, you come onto a list with a screen reader and it's like, list, four items. And it's like, oh, well, that's great because as a non-sighted user, I know I'm not going to be here all day. I'm just going to get through four things and I can arrow through. But, you know, if it was just 200 divs in a row, they'd be like, this sucks. This is not helpful to me. So there's a difference. In but like you're saying, it's like grammar plus programming. Almost.
Oh, yeah, like it's that. Semantics plus activating APIs and toolkits that are embedded in the browser.
Yeah.
That you may or may not know about. Because, yeah, some of them are for devices, input devices or output devices that maybe you don't use or you're not aware of. But you are, like the color picker or the H2 being read by a screen reader or...
Right.
You know, you're actually using, you're asking the browser, hey, I have a video file. I want you to put a whole bunch of video controls here. Do that. Put the video controls on the thing. I don't want to program that. You have that in you. You do it.
There's so much to know.
What's a color picker on a Braille display? What is it? Literally, Dave Rupert does not, I can't fathom it. I like have no concept for what a color picker on a Braille display, like 16 little bumpy guys, you know, I don't know what that's like, but it matters to people. And that's very important.
Right. So let the browser engineers do some of that work. Let the operating system engineers do some of that work. And then when you make a website, you leverage that work that someone else did for you.
Think of how much we have to talk about here. We're just scratching the surface. There's a ton to know just about HTML. There's a ton to know just about CSS. That's why it makes it such a hot topic whenever it's brought up, which if you're part of the Twitterverse or places where developers hotly talk to each other, there are not a week goes by ever where there isn't some conversation that's like, you know, front HTML and CSS people are programmers too. And, you know, there'll be some battle about it every week because it's like, it really just is complicated to have a really strong commanding knowledge of HTML and CSS alone is massive. And if you actually have it, you're like, no, there actually is a lot here, you know?
I've heard the Kirsten, I think it was Eli Finch talking about like utility CSS stuff, which I'm not the hugest fan, but he made a good argument in this video. But it was, you know, CSS is a very like, you have to learn it. Like you learn it piece by piece. Some pieces are easy, background color, those are like, oh, okay, I get that. I see what it does. But kind of the long part picture of CSS is, you know, hundreds of properties and values and things like that. So you kind of have to like, it takes a big, you have to study it. You have to learn kind of all these combinations and keep them in memory. So it's a little different than, you know, it just is a special skill. It's a lot of learning, but you.
Yeah. And I think for CSS, the kind of one of the important core things that folks should learn. I don't know that there are the best ways to learn it yet, but if you write CSS for long enough, you end up figuring this out, you end up learning it, which is the mental model of layout. How does layout work? How does sizing work? How do things become the size that they are when they end up on the page? And I think that over the last 10 years, or, you know, especially before 2017, there was a sense of like, we've got a handle on this. You put a width, percent width on everything. You float everything. You put some margins on everything that are also percents, and that's, you're good. And the message of the last, what's this now been, 3 years, is basically, okay, that was nice, but also horrendously horrible. So let's ignore it. Let's forget all of those things that we used to depend on. Except you probably have to maintain an old code base. So you can't quite forget it yet. But if you're writing a new thing, don't think about those old things. And let's like learn the new model. Let's learn the new model that has everything to do with grid and Flexbox, using Flexbox the way that it was intended to be used and not the way that we were using it before grid came along. And the stuff that we are going to talk about today, like aspect ratios and sizing and fit content and min content, max content, intrinsic sizing, like what the heck is all that stuff? And I feel like it's not an infinite amount of information to learn. And once people have a chance to really start to understand it, the new model, the real, guess what? We finally have a layout system on the web in CSS. We don't have a pile of hacks. We actually have a layout system, finally. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful creature. And then knowing the code and the syntax is much, much easier if you have that mental model in your head. So that's the thing I've been wanting to get more to. Like I have this whole course in my head that's been sitting in my head for 3 years that I've been wanting to do to teach exactly that. But we're going to talk about some of that today.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by X-Team. Gotta check this out. This is so cool. It's literally x-team.com. Love dashes and domain names, of course, by the way. But the idea is that, so let me explain it. You can hire them. They have this tribe of developers, and those developers, they'll, you know, parachute in and help your team do stuff. You know, like, gosh, I need some more developer help on this thing. Where do I turn? Go to X-Team and you hire them to help you build your thing. That's cool, but that's almost not what I'm talking about here. They're also looking for developers to join their team to be one of those developers that goes and helps other people. You know, it's a completely 100% remote company. And so by parachuting, I mean, literally, like figuratively, you know, like you don't actually parachute in, you just help them remotely. And you help them scale. So if a company's like, yeah, we got to scale right now, they're going to reach out to X Team and you're going to be one of those developers that goes and helps those companies, which help really awesome companies like Riot Games, who make like League of Legends. Wouldn't that be cool? Kaplan, Coinbase, Fox Broadcasting, Beachbody, all kinds of, you know, like who knows what you're going to work on, but they have a bunch of cool clients. So chances are you're going to work for multiple of those cool clients. So you can, if you choose, live and work in one of their roaming hacker houses, probably not right at the moment with the pandemic and all, but that's a thing that they have. It changes locations monthly. And I don't know, it just gives you a chance to explore the world, explore beautiful locations, take part in their adventures, and, you know, share passion of coding with the people you live with. Pretty darn cool. There's all kinds of great benefits too. Like they give you $2,500 a year just to like spend on doing things that you love to be healthy and energized and all that. You know, go to conferences, you know, buy some video games, buy some cool photography equipment. $2,500 of just like bonus bucks to spend on stuff. That's pretty cool. Anyway, X Team seems very cool. I guess check them out for either reason. Do you need to get some devs on your team real quick? You know, you hire them to do that. But the important thing is, does that lifestyle sound cool to you? Do you want to be a part of a team that does that? Go do it. Apply. Be a developer like that. Sounds awesome to me. Yeah, let's do this aspect ratio thing. So there's a new thing in CSS. Now, these things are funny. They're not like JavaScript libraries where some developer just invents it in their head and then it ships and it's V1, you know, it doesn't just like arrive, you know, it gets talked about forever and it rolls out in different browsers differently and there's spec stuff and browser stuff and nobody knows that better than Jen, but let's just call it a new thing for the sake of understanding it. It's a CSS property. The property is aspect ratio, aspect dash ratio, and it takes a value, something like 1:4 or slash. Something. Yeah, I said dash. I meant slash. Like a, you know, how you might express an aspect ratio in text, you know, like a slash. I know CSS is getting hot with slashes lately. I feel like love slashes. And it does something. And when I first saw it, I had a million questions. I was just like, oh my gosh, another thing that can influence the size of what an element is sized at. That's going to be complicated because there's already all kinds of stuff that can influence how big a box is. So my mind reeled with, okay, what does it actually do? What is it? How is it influenced by other things that size a box? And then my question is like, what, when does it ever win? You know, is it, how powerful is it? Is kind of where my brain goes. But also, so let me just shut up. Jen, what's up with aspect ratio?
So there's some complicated questions that I want us, I hope we have time, we'll definitely try to get to them. But let's start with the simple thing. So if you have an image, and let's say your image is 400 pixels wide by 300 pixels tall, which means that it's 4 units wide and 3 units tall. You could express that image as a 4x3 image. And in fact, in the world of television for a long time, that's exactly what televisions were. They were all 4x3. So if you ever float around with filmmakers and video makers and such, you know, you're constantly saying 4x3 or whatever. And then, like, for instance, television switched to quote unquote widescreen, and everybody talks about 16x9 because instead of being 4 units wide and 3 units tall, most television, in fact, if you go to a television store today, the television you go home with is going to be a television that's 16 units wide and 9 units tall. There's all this math in the video world, but I won't talk about it right now because I'll just be more confusing. So, but that idea of an aspect ratio, and in the world of television, for instance, when you say 16:9, it's always the width first and the height second. And that was one of the debates among many that we had over the last debating the CSS property, because that's actually the inverse of how other things in CSS work, but it's going to be like 16:9. So you could say aspect dash ratio colon 16/9, and you would basically be saying, hey, the thing I'm putting this CSS property on, I would like you to be 16:9. So let's imagine you have an empty div, blank empty div, and you put a background color on it of pink, and you put aspect ratio 16:9 on it, then what you're going to get is a box that is going to be 16:9. Although probably, especially if you come from that decade of responsive web design where everything has a percent width on it, so you might imagine in the Western writing modes, in the horizontal TB writing mode, which is the default on the web, that the width, you might give it a width. So you might give it a width of 50%, or you give it a width of 100%.
Let's say you didn't. It would be 0 pixels tall, right? Because it just...
No, but let's start with the simple thing. So let's say you tell the box to be 1,000 pixels wide, and you tell the box to be like a div. You tell this div, I want you to be 1,000 pixels wide, and I want you to have an aspect ratio of 16:9. Then what it's going to do, or let's say the aspect ratio is 2/1, 2/1. So what it would do is to say, oh, so we're going to make the 1,000 be the 2, and then we need to make the height be 1. So, oh, the height's going to be 500. So what the browser's doing is it's transferring the calculation. It knows how wide to make that div, and then it transfers the aspect ratio, it uses the aspect ratio to sort of calculate and transfer into a height. So then the height is 500 pixels. So it's, in some ways, it's very simple. That's what it does. Now, the reason it works is because height is set to auto by default.
Mm.
So you have a width of 1,000, you have height of auto, and an aspect ratio of 2/1. So the width of 1,000 pixels transferred height of a 500 pixels.
It does the other one. So
it does the other one.
Elements have a width already because it's width auto.
Right.
So, and then it'll make the height for you.
That's a good way to say it. So let's say that div had a width, instead of having a specific width of 1,000 pixels, maybe it had a width of auto. Maybe you didn't give that div a width or a height. You said nothing about the height or the width of that div, and it had a width and a height of auto. What, by default, the browser will do is it will make, in a horizontal TB writing mode, it will make that width be 100% of the containing block. So maybe the container that it's in is 1,000 pixels. And so the width becomes, it just fills up. If it's a div, it fills up. If it's a block display block level element, if it's a block, like an inline level element, we'll do something different. But if it's a block level element, it will fill that width 100% by default. So it will be 1,000 pixels. So then you didn't say be 1,000 pixels, but it is 1,000 pixels because it's the same as its containing block that has a size. I mean, it might be nested 4 levels deep, and maybe the direct parent is also auto, and the grandparent is auto, and the great grandparent is auto, and the great 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 grandparent is 1,000 pixels. So it might have that. It might have it that size, like kind of transferred down. But, and this probably sounds very complicated as I say it in words, but I think that anybody who manipulates CSS you already know this, that like you have a headline, you didn't put a width on that headline. The headline is in a section. It has the width of the headline is the width of the section. And the height of the headline is auto. So the height of the headline without aspect ratio, let's talk a little bit about height. If you don't have aspect ratio, you just have a width. The width is going to be either what you told it to be, or it's going to be the size of the containing blocks if it's a block level element, because it's going to be auto, and the auto means, hey, be as big as you can be and stay inside your containing block. Height, by default, if you have an empty div, the height of the empty div, what is it? It's zero. So you can't even see the div. You could put a background on it, but you're not going to see it, because the height of an empty div, a truly empty div, is going to be zero. But the height of a headline, let's say we have a headline of six words, the height of the headline is going to be min content size. It's going to be the size it needs to be in order to hold the content. And if you make the browser windows narrower, and if everything is flexible, then the width gets narrower of that headline. And what happens? The height gets taller. The height gets taller because the words start wrapping, right? So we sort of have this sense of, we know this. If you know CSS, you know this organically. You may just never have thought about it consciously. But that's what height auto does. Height auto is going to be min content size. It's going to, in the, we're talking about, we're not switching writing modes. You can switch the writing modes, in which case everything will flip the other direction, in which case everything I've just said about width is height, and everything I just said about height is width. And it goes, it works both ways. All of this stuff works both ways perfectly. Mm. But we're not going to talk about both writing modes, because then we'll really break everybody's brain.
Okay, so first of all, you're not, let's say you apply neither a height or a width to an element, but you do apply an aspect ratio, 2:1 or 16:9 or whatever you want. It actually, yeah, this is where I confuse myself. I thought that it wouldn't do anything, but it does do something.
It does.
Because the width is already like, it's, I know it's not actually 100%, but it's kind of like 100%. It's auto. Yeah, it fills the whole area.
Yep.
If it's a block level element, that is. And so it's 16:9 then. That's beautiful. You have background pink on it. You'll see a 16:9 pink box. But let's say the content in it then pushes it too big for itself. Does it behave like you put a height on it and lock that background color and itself?
It is what we would want it to be. So let's imagine an H2. You've got an H2. It's got six words in it. And you have width of auto on it because most boxes, because what is a web
don't
page?
Don't have a width at all.
You know? It's got a gazillion trillion boxes. Even if you write CSS properties, you write width 100 times, you probably have 1,000 boxes. So the other 900 boxes have width auto on them, right? So let's say you've got this H2. The H2 has no width applied, it has no height applied, but it's in a section element, and the section element is going to have some sort of size. And so the width of that H2 is going to be the width of the section element. Let's pretend at some magical moment it's 1,000 pixels. Pixels wide. The height of the H2 is going to be without using aspect ratio, it's going to be the min content size. So if the headline's on one line, it will be the height of one line of text. If the headline is on two lines, it will be two lines of text. If you say aspect ratio 1:1, you could say aspect ratio 1:1, which basically says, hey, I want you to be a square.
Yep.
Then what will happen is that headline will be 1,000 pixels tall. Or let's say it's in a box. Let's say the section is now 400 pixels wide. Then the headline box will be 400 pixels tall. It will be hot pink, purple text, because that's what you said.
Yeah.
The text maybe will take one or two lines, and then you'll have a whole bunch of empty space so that the box for the headline is a square at all times. But then let's say you make the browser window really, really, you make the containing block, really, the section. You make the section containing block really, really, really narrow,
right,
and it's only 200 pixels wide, and your H2 is pretty big, and it wraps seven times.
Yep.
Your aspect ratio box is going to grow and be enough. It's still going to be min content size, and the min content size.
This is the moment. It now, for lack of a better word, ignores your aspect ratio. It doesn't care what
your aspect ratio. We debated that extensively. Yeah. It ignores your aspect ratio because that's what authors are going to want. They're not going to want aspect ratio. You're not going to want to have the H2 like sticking out of its own box, especially because the paragraph that comes along after it is going to come along right underneath it. And what you would get is colliding text. And one of the main principles of CSS is that
avoiding data loss in that way.
Avoiding
like overlapping,
data loss.
Yeah.
Avoid data loss. That's why in the CSS is awesome meme, the word awesome sticks out of the box. Because if you truncated the word awesome and you cut off the sum part, you would get CSS is aw, and that doesn't mean the same thing. And one of the core principles of CSS is to avoid data loss. So in this case, the aspect ratio, the height of that box will min content. It's like min content always and aspect ratio
Right.
If aspect ratio is more than min content, unless you write it differently, because you can write additional syntax, which I don't remember right now, and tell it, I want you to always be a square no matter what. I don't care if stuff sticks out, always be a square.
Well, you can also do that with like a max height or something. You could, if you, you know, if you're concerned about it growing too tall on you, you can force it not to.
And yeah, I should know exactly how to do that, because I did know before I was sick for 2 months.
So min content wins or beats aspect ratio by default. And so that's awesome. Like that was just a concern, because everyone wants a square, and then they resize it on mobile and they're like,
this is what does it for me. You know what? Aspect ratio never wins, ever. It's the weakest thing you can do. It's just a suggestion. But if anything else beats it, content, other properties, anything, it loses. It's just, that's what it seems like to me.
Maybe. See, if Elika Entomet was on the call, she would know definitively the answer to that question.
There is also precedent for this growth thing. I know that one of the most popular ways to do aspect ratio now without this, and we should talk about that too, because the browser support for like Safari, which I guess you'll find out on Monday, we don't know what's happening with aspect ratio at Safari. At least I don't. There's no support at all where there is support in the other browsers.
There's no support anywhere, but Firefox is working on it. We were the ones who wrote the spec, and
yeah.
Chrome team is also working on it. They might actually ship first, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now in Canary. That's why I was able to mess around.
I'm so happy Chrome is on board with it. But it's funny sometimes when like everyone thinks Chrome invents everything if they happen to ship it first. And it's like,
I'm looking forward to being released from this prison. Do you think? I mean, I want to use it on like video iframes. Is that a great use case? Where would people be using aspect?
I would think so.
Right. So like, okay. Images, so before I answer that question, let me answer the other thing that comes up. Related to what we were just talking about. So we were talking about when you have a width of auto or width of a defined length and a height of auto, the aspect ratio will transfer the height across. It will calculate the height based on the transferred size. And if you have both or auto in the horizontal writing mode, there is a width, so it gets transferred. But what if you say height? What if you say, I want width of 100% and I want height of 200 pixels?
Yeah, you get the free, it does it the other direction too, right?
No, you get what you asked for. You get width of 100% and you get height of 200 pixels. Or you get width of 500 pixels and you get height of 200 pixels. And aspect ratio is ignored in that case. So aspect ratio only works, the aspect ratio property only works if at least one of height or width is auto. If neither one of them is auto, it's not going to do anything.
But if you use aspect ratio auto width and set a height, you will get a width from it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. If width is auto. So that's an interesting use case where let's say you have a headline and you say it's 1:1. You say I want it to be a square and the width is auto. If height is also auto, then width will be the size of the containing block and it will be a square unless there's too much content, in which case it will grow. But if you say height 200 pixels, it will, and let's imagine actually it's an empty div and not a headline. So we remove the content size, intrinsic size of the content from the imagined demo. If you have an empty div and you have width of auto and you have height of 200 pixels and you have aspect ratio of 1:1, it will transfer from the height to the width.
It will, yeah. And just like responsive design and media queries and stuff, I think that's going to be much rarer. The width aspect ratios are way more natural to the web.
This is where you're tapping into what I've been trying to do for the last 5 years, which is just please stop thinking like it's 2010 and responsive web design is the hot thing, because I think there's a lot of a potential creativity where you could say width auto height 200 or min height 200 aspect ratio 1:1, and you get yourself a whole bunch of squishy boxes that are never bigger than 200 by 200 pixels and sometimes are smaller when there's not enough space. We should be thinking about where to set heights on things. We should be thinking about how we can... You could put a height of 10 viewport height units, VH units, 10 VH units, and have yourself 10 little squares. And transfer this width across using the aspect ratio property and make some really beautiful designs.
I think that's really cool because you make a grid or whatever. The default thing is like it all just collapses, or you have to like set a height. But you know, if you're like, if I just wanted these to be like little squares everywhere, like, or a rectangle based Mondrian grid or what, you know, like you can start kind of doing that very easily with minimal code.
Minimal code and an incredible amount of robustness. So you could do a layout where there's a whole bunch of squares. And anytime there's the content, like they're all teasers for something, and they're all like that post, a jazz poster that I made a long time ago, where there were all these squares, and each one was a different event. And so there was the name of the event and the date and the like list of the artists at the event. And you never know how much content there is or not. And in the original poster design, all of those boxes were squares. And because it was laid out in InDesign or Quark Express or whatever, you know, the graphic designer could fuss with it until it worked perfectly. But on the web, you can't. On the web, you got to make sure that, hey, somebody puts three artists in there instead of one, or they put a really long title instead of a short title. I just want it to work. I don't want to have to like have them submit a bug report and me submit a hot fix to the CSS. Like, it should just work. So you could be like, hey, there's all these squares with all these events in it, and they're cool. In fact, you don't even need the content. I mean, if alignment would ship for blocks, which is a whole other thing, then you wouldn't even need, you could have the content be like set vertically centered inside the square, or you could throw a flexbox at it to get this work or grid. The content wouldn't have to be at the top with the empty space at the bottom. You could make the content sit at the bottom of the box with the empty space at the top.
Oh,
you could
vertically
center the content.
I didn't even think of that outside the context of grid or flexbox.
Once you have height and you have extra height, then you have all sorts of artistic creativity to what to do with that extra space. And then, oh, if there's extra content, the content's longer, then sure, the box should grow taller. That's cool. And oh, you know what? It's in grids, inside grids. So actually the whole row grew taller. Awesome. No problem. Like when you combine these things, there's so much potential there.
Fantastic. So what I meant by precedent is that if you want to do this now, there's a couple of tactics. Generally, they involve setting a padding top on an element, which is somehow just completely bizarrely a percentage of padding top is based on the width, not the height, which is just a thing that is on the web. And then you make, you know, you set the height to zero. So the only height is based on the percentage of the width. And then you absolutely position probably a child within that space. And that's really limited and doesn't work like this, because then if content hangs out of the bottom of it, it just hangs out of the bottom of it, which gave rise to another way of doing this in which that you use a pseudo element to like, you know, that's like 1 pixel wide or whatever, that pushes the element down by 16 by 9. And then if content over, it's like it only does pushing, but if the content were to push farther, it can still keep going. It's kind of like min aspect ratio or something, which is interesting, but nothing comes close to it being this easy and this robust.
This is very intuitive and very makes sense, where that padding hack is kind of an artifact of actually a mistake that the CSS working group made. It was a deliberate decision, but it was a looking back probably the wrong decision about what to do if you have a top or bottom padding, top or bottom padding, that's a percent. Because it's like a percent of what? A percent of the height of the box, but the height of the box is dependent on it's like a circular pattern. So they decided to, instead of depending on the height, they just calculated off the width. So it's this weird thing that's actually a way to transfer a size across. But I don't think the CSS working group would do that again. Oh, but I wanted to talk about, because you asked about the video and the iframes. So
yeah, I guess, where do you see people using it?
Here's where I want to explain the difference between a replaced element and a non-replaced element, because it matters a lot when it comes to sizing, and aspect ratio is part of sizing. So an image is a great example of a replaced element, where if you just have the HTML file and you have no other files and you read the HTML file, the image isn't actually in the HTML file. And here I'm setting aside the data. There's a way you can like actually encode your HTML file into this massive data thing and stick it in there. But pretend that you can't do that. Like pretend like the HTML says image equals, or image source equals quote, and then there's a URL to a file. But if you read the HTML and you look at the headline or the paragraph, the headline and the paragraphs are actually there. They're in the HTML. So when the browser paints, it puts everything together, builds the web page. It takes the H1s and the paragraphs and it puts them on the page. Those are called a non-replaced element. That's actually the paragraph on the page. It's actually the headline on the page. It was not replaced. Where images, and there's a few others as well, I'll talk about in a minute, are replaced elements. The image element is like a little note that says, hey, browser, you got to go get the thing and stick it here. Go get the image file and stick it here. Go get the video file for a video element and stick it here. Go get the audio file for an audio element and stick it here. Not only the audio file and the audio and the video file, but also the video controls, the audio controls, or we were talking about this before with form fields. Go get that drop-down selecty thing and stick it here. Go get that radio button set that you have inside yourself and stick it here, right? So those are all replaced elements. The way that sizing is handled with replaced elements and non-replaced elements is different. And I think it's one of these things that intuitively we kind of know that, like the way that sizing and the stuff around widths and percent widths and how tall is something for an element, for an image element is different than, say, a headline element. Where the headline, so images, for instance, are an element, a replaced element, that has an intrinsic aspect ratio. If I go into Photoshop and I make an image and I make a square image and I put it into the web page and we put a percent on that image, we put 100% width on that image's height always adjusts with the width. It maintains its own, because the image knows, I'm a square. Hi, I'm a square. I know I'm a square. Oh, you want me to be 400 pixels wide? Guess what? I'll also be 400 pixels tall. You would like me to be 1,000 pixels wide? Guess what? I'll also be 1,000 pixels tall. It has an intrinsic aspect ratio. So this new aspect ratio CSS property is basically taking a lot of the mechanisms inside the browser that were already written, the ideas, the patterns that were already made for intrinsic aspect ratios, and it's giving front-end developers, authors, a tool, the aspect ratio property, to explicitly define an aspect ratio and to give an aspect ratio to an element that doesn't have an intrinsic aspect ratio. So headlines don't have an intrinsic aspect ratio. Paragraphs don't have an intrinsic aspect ratio. You know what else doesn't have an intrinsic aspect ratio most of the time? Iframes.
Because they're just 300 pixels tall, right? You have no...
300 by 150.
Yeah. You can give it a width and a height in the attributes in HTML, but you can't give it an aspect ratio.
Right.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So it's not a replaced element? I guess not, really.
I don't know. This is where I would find myself a browser engineer who knows these. Yeah, like maybe it
so
is.
So will aspect ratio work on an iframe pretty well?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's one of the major use cases because
YouTube,
Vimeo, embedded videos from any third-party service. Like most of us don't use the video element natively because we want to do adaptive bitrate streaming, which means we actually want to have 14,000 separate little video files that get swapped out depending on the data rate of the bandwidth of the user and blah, 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 screen size, blah, 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 complicated. Go look up adaptive bitrate streaming if you're curious. But you use YouTube, you don't make one copy of your video, put it on your server next to your CSS file and point to that one video using the video element. And YouTube uses a video element, but it's like inside of this whole complicated, fancy thing that swaps out all the stuff depending on the speed of the data and the size of the screen. And that all gets wrapped up inside an iframe. It probably isn't a replaced element, actually. It probably technically, but it doesn't have an intrinsic aspect ratio, iframes. So This is a way to explicitly give an iframe an intrinsic aspect ratio, which means you could say, I mean, all of this complicated stuff is to basically say, hey, if I put a YouTube video on my webpage and I say width of 100% right now, the width will shrink and morph with the containing block. It'll be awesome, except the height will stay 360 pixels. And the video will get cropped, and then I will be sad. So what's the solution? The solution is usually people don't make their YouTube videos squishy. They make them fixed size, or they go get FitJS or some JavaScript library and throw a JavaScript solution at it. Once aspect ratio ships, instead we can say, hey, aspect ratio 16:9 for this video, this iframe, which is my video element, please. Or perhaps you could even put a data element into the iframe, and then you could say your CSS wouldn't have to say 16 by 9. Your CSS could have a variable in there or something, or could have like a data attribute in there, or it could have maybe an adder. If adder would ship ATTR, like you could say, get the width and the height attributes from the HTML and put those
into does exist, but the ones that are typed, right, that you can actually pass a pixel value in.
Yeah. It'd be nice to just grab the height and width attributes off of the iframe code, and then just so you could have one line of CSS that's just like, take the intrinsic, you know, make explicit the aspect ratio that would be calculated from the width and height aspect ratio. Which, hey, that sounds remarkably like what we shipped for image loading last December. Why? Yeah. Oh, because we figured this out. I figured this out while we were creating the aspect ratio CSS property. I was like, why isn't this used to solve that problem with the image loading?
This is a fascinating connection, right? So weirdly, that shipped first, but this was you and Elika being like, why don't images work like this? You bringing it up and having them be like, oh, they could.
I was like, was like, hey, let's just throw this line of code into the UA style sheet. Aspect ratio slash colon adder width slash adder height for all image elements. I'm like, that would solve the image loading problem. And she was like, and then we went and found Emilio, an engineer at Mozilla, and he was like, oh, I could do that before the CSS property ships. I'll just do that in the HTML code. And he did, and then Chrome did, and then Safari did, and then we all shipped it.
I'll be your legacy, Jen, if something bigger isn't, because that is huge for it reminds me of how big scroll anchoring is, you know, like scroll anchoring that shipped, which is like when you're scrolled down in a browser, the browser really tries to like keep you there, even if crap happens above it and doesn't push you down. This is similar to that that helped stop a lot of jank. So does this. It stops a ton of jank. Anyway, Dave.
I have a zinger. So I set aspect ratio 1:1, 1:1.
Yep.
And on my image aspect ratio 1:1, and oopsie doopsie, I loaded a portrait iframe or iPhone photo in there. What happens to my image? Does it explode the aspect ratio, or does it kind of squinch down? Do we know yet? Maybe we don't know yet.
We do know. Let's see if I can remember.
If I lied.
I mean, you're basically asking the question, hey, the image has an intrinsic aspect ratio of, let's say the image is inherently a square, but I tell the image to be 16 by 9. Which one wins? I think the aspect ratio wins, and then you can put object fit on it, for instance. So if you have a whole bunch of different size images and you want them all to be squares, like, or you want them all to be 16 by 9.
Isn't there another keyword, though? There's something that I think contain aspect ratio or something like that is another keyword related to all this that is the object fit equivalent of how it. Sorry, I don't know much about it, but I know there's something on my radar to look. It's in the spec. It's not aspect ratio. I think it's contain aspect ratio. We're really weird.
I am very enthralled by this. I need to play with it. I'm just like, I have all these situations. Like I have this like bookshelf on my website and it's a bunch of book covers, but lo and behold, some authors decide they're not going to just do a normal size book. They're going to do like a weirdo size book. And so I'm like, oh shoot, what would I do there? And right now I'm kind of doing like a draw square, you know, or it's like got a height or width auto and a height, you know, but wouldn't it be cool if these were all just square boxes that the image just filled, and that's exactly what you're promising. And so that's wonderful. So that's what I want.
Here's the answer.
Good.
The attributes in HTML will set an intrinsic size, and auto, if things are set to auto will go and look for the intrinsic size and the intrinsic aspect ratio. But if CSS comes along and says, I want you to have this width, I want you to have this height, I want you to have this aspect ratio, CSS is going to always win.
Okay.
That's what we're used to,
sense.
Right?
I mean, that's the author specified.
CSS will win. So like if, you know, right now, if you have an image that's actually a square and you tell it to be in CSS 400 pixels wide and 17,000 pixels tall, it will do what you told it to do. And so this is the same, where the aspect ratio in CSS will override the intrinsic aspect ratio of the image itself, or the calculated aspect ratio coming off of the attributes in HTML and CSS in HTML. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, cool.
And then it gets even more complicated with SVGs.
Oh gosh.
That might,
That's for another show, probably. We're a little over because there's another thing that I want to talk about, but we're not going to have time, which is this a good candidate for at supports? And I might to be the bearer of bad news, but because this because the fallbacks require some like HTML and a very different approach that if you have to program it both ways, it's like you might as well. I don't know. It doesn't feel quite right.
Well, I think it depends. It depends on the use case. It depends on what you're using it for. If you're using it to make your teaser boxes be squares every time that there's enough space, you know, there's like the content will still fit inside the square, then the fallback would be, okay, well, they're not squares. They're like their own intrinsic size. Yeah. That might not be bad at all.
But if you rely on the aspect ratio to make the shape at all, because maybe they're contentless squares or something, then you'd be screwed.
Well, for instance, if you have YouTube videos that are squishy and the only solution you have to having them maintain their aspect ratio is to use a CSS property that's only supported in half your users' browsers, then the other half of your users are going to get really messed up YouTube videos. Like, that's not a solution, right? So it depends. It depends on what the consequence is for the lack of support. And if it's bad enough, then... But you could use as supports to try that out, and then you could apply the padding hack the rest of the time, or you could apply a JavaScript library that only loads if needed, or, you know, you could have a thing in your JavaScript that says, hey, run this JavaScript if this property, CSS property, is not supported. And if it is supported, then don't do it. And that brings up a question, though, of, like, is it worth the engineering effort if there's not 100% coverage, because, you know, you got to do all the work for the hard way and then you toss in the easy way for why? Like, you already did the hard part. Why bother with the easy part? But it's going to ship in multiple browsers almost simultaneously. So we might actually see it ship pretty rapidly. So we'll have to see how it goes.
Cool. Well, thank you, Jen, so much for coming on the show. And it's always good to get a picture of where HTML, CSS, and all that are going. So thank you very much. And
for
those who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Jen Simmons on Twitter, jensimmons.com website. I have a Layoutland YouTube channel with a lot of videos where I go into lots of things like how to use Object Fit or how to do responsively fallbacks, or not responsive, progressively enhanced CSS fallbacks. And there's a video. Oh, we should probably put in the show notes, too, a link to a video that explains what we were sort of zipping past with the image loading and how it changed last December.
Yeah, awesome.
And go take my HTML course on Lynda, LinkedIn Learning. I think it's actually free right now, actually.
Yeah, check it out. Yeah, it's on the one-month trial. That's what I'm saying. I might be an NAB.
I think there's some kind of, I think they put together some kind of like hey, COVID, you're at home learning stuff. Here's a set of courses that you should take. We're going to make them all free for a little while kind of plan. A lot of people have access through their work or through their school or through their local library and don't realize it. Like, I think every New Yorker can just use the New York Public Library system to get to LinkedIn Learning for free.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again, Jen. And this is great. We'll put a link to that video, the aspect ratio video or image thing, because it really, the way we embed images is back to the old way, which is now the new good way. So that's good.
And people have been very confused. They think that the image loading thing with the with width and height attributes in HTML is somehow the same as the CSS aspect ratio property, and it's like no, they're technically similar, and there was a story about the history of how they came about that is connected, but they're actually very, very, very separate things. One has to do with image loading, and the other one has to do with layout and CSS. So watch the video all the way through, and I explain it. So
perfect. Well, thank you. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast your choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. Head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get brand new one because people want to hire people like you. Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Nope. Shoptalkshow.com.